Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoppe. We're talking about the history of scurvy with the Mellon Professor of Humanities at Vanderbilt University, Professor Jonathan Lamb, author of a great book called Scurvy, The Disease of Discovery. The contention is that during the years when people started to make ocean voyages, their technical skill, their ability to traverse great distances, however, was undermined by their poor understanding of nutrition. Nutrition took several centuries to catch up with these voyagers. And traditionally, we hear of Sir James Lind, the discoverer of scurvy. So we learn in our simplistic textbooks, and he discovered that if you gave sailors limes, they didn't get scurvy, and all was copacetic thereafter. But our guest, Dr. Jonathan Lamb, has a little bit of a different version of that story. What actually did happen?
Well, Lind was a great clinician. He ran a clinical trial in 1747 on a ship called the Salisbury, which had some very bad scorbutic cases. And so he took target groups and fed them different kinds of foods. And he discovered, without a shadow of a doubt, that if the ones that had been given oranges and lemons recovered. Oranges seemed to be the best, lemons were the second best remedy. But other remedies like sulfuric acid and portable soup. I mean, the battery of anti-scorbutics that Cook was carrying, these didn't work so well.
He was kind of like Edison with a light bulb. He was like a series of random experiments until he just, got the filament right. It was a little bit trial and error.
So here, this fantastic discovery. I mean, people had known oranges and lemons cured scurvy. I mean, what Lind did was he had that home. There was now no doubt about it. The body needed whatever was in those fruits. And Lind then proceeded to make a mistake. The history of scurvy is a long and undecided contest between two schools of thought. One is that scurvy was caused by toxic food. There was something in the food itself that was vitiated that poisoned you, and that was what scurvy was. And there was another school, it was the correct school, which was that there was a deficiency in food. There was something in your food there was something not in your food that you needed. And nobody knew what this was. But whatever it was in oranges and lemons, according to Lind. Now, Lind then said that although oranges and lemons could cure scurvy, he did not believe that they could prevent it. Mm. And that was simply not true. If you ate a really good diet before you went to sea, you'd have at least 3 months clear of scurvy.
So he just thought they were good medicine for scurvy. That the cause of scurvy was hitherto unknown, foul humors.
He was a toxic food man. He thought it was definitely poisoned food that gave you scurvy. That meant that people like Trotter, when they read this in Trotter's Treatise of the Scurvy, Trotter couldn't believe it. He thought, here is a man who discovered what scorbutic sailors needed, and yet was resisting the logical conclusion that there would be a preventive that would be based on that. And I mean, it was in the 70s, it was like 40 years before the implications of Lind's discovery were actually put to use as preventives. That's when Sir Gilbert Blane and Trotter were insisted that the Admiralty order concentrated lime juice to be available on all ships. Mm. And that's generally reckoned to have been the reason why the British Navy did so well in the Napoleonic Wars. But the reason it took 40 years was not just, resistance to Lind's conclusions. I mean, it was resistance to Lind's conclusions, but that resistance was given a powerful fillip by a man called McBride, who had suggested the reason that people got scurvy was that they didn't have enough carbon dioxide in their systems. Hmm. And the way to get this was to not have concentrated orange or lemon juice or lime juice. It was to have concentrated malt. And that became for 40 years the official Admiralty preventive. And it was one that Cook very equivocally endorsed in the speech he gave to the Royal Society about his first voyage. But he did say that malt work was a good preventive. But he said he didn't think it would cure a full-blown case of scurvy.
Is there any vitamin C in malt, does it turn out?
No, there's none.
Oh, okay. There's none. I know they used to give grog to British sailors.
All the clinical trials that were run on malt wort were probably curing something else. I think it's possible. Nobody's done any work on this. It's a really fruitful area to do some. But it's possible that in malt wort, in concentrated malt, there were elements of vitamins B1
maybe some
and
B3.
Bees,
yeah.
So they would be curing pellagra and beriberi, which often were confused with scurvy. So it's possible that there was some that there was some remedial function in malt wort, but that's never been decided. But I mean, a lot of historians of naval medicine have said that McBride and McBride put the cause and Cook put the cause of lime juice back by 40 years. I mean,
they'd stumbled on the cure, and yet they sort of booted it. And it took until the 20th century that they characterized ascorbic acid. Was it Albert St. Georgie who did some of the initial work on that in the 1930s?
Yes,
and then ultimately identified. Identified that it was, it actually wasn't the first vitamin that was, quote, discovered. I think the work of someone before that had characterized beriberi as a thiamine deficiency. And I guess it wasn't till the 30s that it was conclusively shown that vitamin C was the agent responsible for, or lack thereof, was responsible for scurvy with St. Georgie. And then, of course, subsequently there was Linus Pauling, who weighed in with the belief that vitamin C is a panacea for virtually everything.
Well, I met somebody the other day who is very much of that opinion. He said for 5 years he'd been suffering chronic fatigue syndrome and finally realized that what he needed were huge doses of scurvy. I mean, huge doses of vitamin C. There's been a medical paper recently saying that in cases of sepsis, intravenous supplies of vitamin C will cut mortality by 3/4.
Indeed, that's a very important paper. And part of the hypothesis comes from the fact that when animals get sick, they have the ability to endogenously synthesize vitamin C in their livers. And when they get sick or in response to a challenge of some kind, stress, shock, they rev up their production of vitamin C massively, as if vitamin C were an antidote to infection or stress. And perhaps more vitamin C could fulfill that role for humans.
I think this is the latest avenue of research. When Dr. Gunson at the Westmead Clinic for Diabetics in Sydney said all you need to do is take one tablet of vitamin C a day, I mean, that's not strictly true. I think when you're under severe oxidative stress, you need lots and lots of vitamin C. And there's nothing like diabetes for giving you oxidative stress. I think intravenous intravenous applications of vitamin C are probably necessary in some cases.
Indeed,
to counteract the effect.
That's something we believe in. We've talked about it frequently here on Intelligent Medicine. Okay, let's pause for a moment because we want to hear a word from one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back with our discussion today with Dr. Jonathan Lamb. Scurvy, the disease of discovery. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Thanks very much for listening to that message from one of our sponsors. And now back to Dr. Jonathan Lamb. The book is Scurvy, The Disease of Discovery. And so why is it, Dr. Lamb, that scurvy is sometimes referred to as the most secret of diseases? What's up with that?
Well, it was a disgrace to have scurvy on your ship. It was associated with unhygienic conditions, with bad management, certainly with bad nutrition. And after Cook's first voyage in the Pacific on the Endeavour, where he had hardly any cases of scurvy, I mean, possibly one person died of scurvy, but otherwise there were no fatalities from it. All commanders were really under an obligation not to get scurvy on their ships. So when Bligh got scurvy on the Bounty going out to Tahiti, he simply denied it. He said stiff legs and swellings and perhaps a little ulcer or two there. He said, no, that's rheumatism. And in Australia, there are lots of deliberate misdiagnoses of scurvy because it would have been a shameful thing to have a prison population all dying of scurvy, which is what was happening actually in 1834 at Port Arthur in Tasmania, in the prison colony there. So it would get re-diagnosed. I mean, they would call it basically dysentery or typhus. The effect on the skin, they'd call it erysipelas, all sorts of ways of dodging it. And so there was a sort of conspiracy of silence about it. I mean, when Scott got this scurvy.
The Antarctic
explorer.
I mean,
he personally got scurvy, but
the polar explorer, right? He went to Antarctica, right?
Yeah, trying to find the South Pole. And he actually thought of not reporting it at one point, keeping it secret. Because it was so, well, I think people felt it made people melancholy. I mean, once there's a diagnosis of scurvy, people were, their spirits would drop. I mean, Thomas Willis called the melancholy associated with scurvy a falling down of the whole soul. So that was one reason you didn't want anybody to know. The other was that the experiences of scurvy were so incredibly vivid, I mean morbidly vivid, that it was very hard for people to explain to other people, to describe to other people what it was like. And I mean, one of the reasons that the Ancient Mariner has to go on telling his story, because his story never succeeds. He can never explain to any of his listeners how alone he felt when he was on a ship filled with corpses, and the only one survivor.
We're referring to the poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, I guess written in the 1830s. And I don't remember much of it except for the line, water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink.
Yeah.
I think that's where it comes from.
Right.
That's the derivation.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the vivid imaginings there, of the water snakes, are, at the same time at once sort of slimy and horrid and unbelievably gross, are also seen as exquisite and beautiful. And that sort of alternation between, extreme disgust and voluptuous delight is very common in scurvy and equally very difficult to convey to somebody else. So that on a ship with lots of people with scurvy, all looking, the verdant shore and waiting for the ship to land at it so they could get hold of green, green edible vegetables, They weren't a community anymore. I mean, each was filled with a kind of personal sorrow or a personal excitement that was peculiar to them. And Trotter said that one of the most one of the most odd symptoms of scurvy victims was that they would be incredibly circumstantial in telling you about what they felt. So that I think is most intriguing. It means that giving a narrative of scurvy is very difficult.
And you know, perhaps if not for scurvy, we wouldn't have these magnificent works of literature, because you know, these visions and extremes of emotion may have been stoked by vitamin C deficiency. Interesting. There's also the term scurvy knave, which is a term of approbation among pirates. We hear it all the time in pirate stories. But there literally was something repulsive about people suffering from scurvy. They literally stank, right?
Yeah. Well, the best description of it is the end of Orwell's 1984. Because Winston has been starved in prison. And O'Brien, his torturer, says, "Look, I can pull your hair out, you know, you lose hair with scurvy." He says, look at your teeth. And he pulls one of his teeth out.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And he says, look at the ulcers on your legs. You stink like a goat, he says. So he's describing a scorbutic prisoner.
Wow.
Alain Corbin, in his book, The Foul and the Fragrant, says that in the catalog of noisome diseases, scurvy is by far the worst. The smells of people's stools, their breaths, I mean, were all, you know, incredibly offensive.
Wow. Okay. Well,
not a pretty, and it was not pretty to look at. I mean, everybody mentions the leaden pallor and sometimes puffiness of the face and the blackness of the eyes, because a lot of blood was leaking into the subcutaneous tissue. And they must have looked like walking skeletons.
Well, you know, to this day, when I'm, you know, when I get patients or callers on my radio show telling me that they have easy bruisability, I always say, take some additional vitamin C because of its effect on the capillaries. Yeah. Or people with periodontal disease, you know, perhaps it's of bacterial origin, or perhaps there's weakened collagen in the gums and additional vitamin C can't hurt anyway and may be beneficial. Yeah. So certainly vitamin C, I think that the story of scurvy is instructive to us today, because we need to draw firm scientific conclusions. We need to not allow science to be buried by preconceived notions, and have meaningful hypotheses that help us cure disease. And unfortunately, the observations of Sir James Lind didn't yield a full resolution of this problem until the 20th century. And still today we have problems. We're here in the 21st century, and we need to go back to basics.
Yeah, quite.
So,
and I think one of the reasons that we're getting outbreaks of scurvy now is that government policy is failing in some respects. I mean, I think the austerity measures taken in Britain were a big mistake, for example, because malnutrition among old people who were used to getting food like Meals on Wheels and things like that, all that was cut back. And malnutrition rates there have increased in the last 5 years by 44%. It's a bad outlook.
Yeah. And the elderly may be especially prey to this, because their taste buds are altered, their resources are limited, their ability to get out and seek the food that they need is constrained. And they tend to, you know, I sometimes, you know, walk by, a little, deli or a little, you know, one of these little restaurants, and through the window, I'll see a couple of little ladies having an ice cream soda. Well, there's empty calories. There's no nutrition there, but it stokes their taste buds, because their taste buds may be failing, that in part due to nutritional deficiencies. And, you know, it's a vicious cycle of malnutrition.
Yes. Well, I think certainly at all levels. I mean, it seems to me young people are eating very badly now. They're taking in too much sugar, which is not a good look for a diabetic future.
And crisps, and stuff like that, and fried foods, junk, fast food.
I mean, the idea of taxing highly sugared drinks, I think, is a good one, because it would have a huge medical advantage. But I don't know. It's hard to change people's habits, but they ought to be aware of the dangers, because I think without some kind of policy decision on this, without some kind of intervention by concerned groups or by a government, scurvy is going to be a problem.
Indeed. Well, okay. And so our today's Intelligent Medicine call to action is get the book. It's a fascinating history. It's a great read. Scurvy, the Disease of Discovery by Professor Jonathan Lamb, available from the usual sources. And is there a website? I mean, there's a series of great interviews with you, by the way, on, if you Google Scurvy, Disease of Discovery, or if you Google Jonathan Lamb, you'll see some great interviews. You've been interviewed in The Guardian and The Wall Street Journal and a lot of important places, Slate Magazine, I think, with some very interesting insights on the subject.
http://www.jonathanlamb.info. It will get me.
Good stuff. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Lamb.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Hoffman. This has been a real treat.
Interesting story. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.